Hi, and welcome to a special edition of Let's Talk. In this episode, I have two very special guests, my sister Susan and my brother Alan. They join me today to talk about our sister Aoife. Aoife was born severely brain damaged due to lack of oxygen at birth, resulting in a loss of functioning of her limbs and severe cognitive disabilities, which meant that she couldn't talk or communicate beyond smiling or crying. Aoife died in 2011, and after spending our lifetimes with a sibling who was in many ways a mystery, we began slowly unpacking our thoughts and feelings about our memories of her and the realities of a sense of loss that was always somehow present during her lifetime. It's so exciting to have my two amazing siblings here to sit down and talk about something that we've talked about. You know, we have had conversations over the years about Aoife and about how it was to have a sister like Aoife. But I feel really honored that I can sit down with you two here now and talk about her life and about our lives with her and share it with other people in the hopes that other people will benefit from hearing this or maybe just be interested in hearing it. So, although, you know, it will be a chat more than anything, I was thinking that we would just start out by sort of like, what are your kind of earlier memories of having a sister like Aoife? You know, how did your young mind kind of make sense of her or of her life or of her abilities or disabilities? Because I know for me, she was there, you know, already, of course, in the family by the time I came along. So I feel like it wasn't such a big upheaval in my life. You know, I always knew that Aoife was Aoife and she was never any different, and I never had any other kind of expectations of her or anything. But I wonder how it was for you both. Suze, maybe you want to start there?
Well, I suppose the thing about it is I had no expectations either, probably, because, yeah, she was born the day before I turned 4, but Alan was born when I was 3, so maybe I expected another Alan. maybe not, of course, but, you know. So when I think back, what's my earliest memory of her? And I can't put my finger on anything.
Sure.
But the things that do come up for me when I think back is going to see her in Foynes, which was this horrible institution outside of Limerick. So first of all, we had to drive probably about 2.5 hours to get there. We would pack a picnic and eat chicken sandwiches on the side of the road, and I can still almost taste the chicken with the stuffing in it. And we would go to Foynes, which was, it was just awful. You know, it was like a hospital with the very, very, very high ceilings and big expansive corridors, and it was just full of kids who had special needs, were disabled. And I don't think I could wrap my head around it at all. I just remember feeling very, very uncomfortable, scared, and not really knowing what was going on and not feeling any desire to be there. In fact, I don't have any good memories at all of going there. And the other thing that comes up for me is, and this is one of my, I think, earliest memories, is being in school and we were asked to draw a picture of our family. And I would have been 6 or 7 because I remember the teacher in the class. And I drew a picture of Alan, mom, dad, and probably the dog and myself. Mm-hmm. And there was no Aoife in it. Mm. And the teacher actually said to me, you know, where is Aoife? And as far as I remember, I said something like, well, she doesn't live with us, so she's not part of our family.
Wow.
And that is, it's an early memory. It's a bit of a painful memory as well, because I think, I don't know if I necessarily got into trouble, but, you know, the teacher was kind of adamant that Aoife should be in the picture. And, you know, what was it going on for me that I felt, no, she shouldn't. Mm-hmm, and, mm-hmm. You know, I don't really know, but that's how I felt at that young age.
Wow.
And what's it like to sort of think back on that now?
It took me a long time to be able to talk about that. Mm-hmm. But it's a memory that comes up for me a lot. And I suppose over the years, I think, you know, I was confused, probably. Mm-hmm. I didn't really understand perhaps what was going on. Family meant everybody being together in the one home. Mm-hmm. So maybe it was as simple as that. But also just not understanding what was really going on, probably more than anything.
Mm-hmm. It was still very much the dark ages in Ireland, wasn't it? Like 70s, 80s, even 90s, you know, people didn't talk about these things much.
Yeah, there was a bit of embarrassment maybe, or shame about having somebody that was handicapped. It was a word that people didn't use. It wasn't any, you know, I suppose people looked at you with pity.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And maybe when kids are born, it's an exciting time for everyone. And I guess, yeah, it wasn't.
Yeah.
So there's probably pain. There are painful memories associated with maybe not celebrating a birth in the normal way.
Well, what about you, Alan?
I guess for me, early memories, I think similar to you, Suze, was the journey to Foynes. That seems to just stick in my head. I mean, I was 15 months old when she was born, so I don't remember anything about that or the first kind of however many years of her life. But going in the car to Foynes and... like interminable journey, like on sort of pothole-y roads, steamed up car windows and bumpy, you know, just that just seemed like to go on forever. It always seemed to be raining. And and there was something in the kind of, I don't know, what would you call it? The sort of focus it took to get there and back or something. You know, it was hard work to get there.
Emotionally, you mean?
Well, I just think the journey itself was a slog. You know, this was to visit Aoife for an hour or two. And we do it's a whole day. You know, it was a whole day. And also, you know, I guess quite difficult in emotionally as well. And exactly like Sue said, you know, the place itself, Foynes, of course, didn't help because we were, you know, anticipating this kind of grim scenario in this big, echoey, cold building, and what felt like, you know, people who were maybe too busy to give enough time to the kids or us, or, you know, it was just hard. I think they were probably very under-resourced there. Probably didn't have enough people to look after the amount of children who were in the place. So there was no welcome or, you know, it was just you just got on with it. And also I think from our point of view, as a family, not having been kind of, maybe prepared isn't the right word, but not having been educated perhaps as to what was going on with Aoife and, not knowing her condition, or just this kind of acceptance of the idea of handicapped. It was just, you just kind of accepted this handicapped thing. And it was like almost, like Susie's talked about shame. It was like almost like there's something wrong. There's something really wrong. And it's out of your hands in a sense. And out of your realm of understanding, and it didn't help, I guess.
Wow. Yeah. Gosh. I mean, it's hard to imagine nowadays that, you know, somebody wouldn't get a diagnosis. I mean, Aoife didn't even get a formal diagnosis, you know, which is absolutely shocking. You know, I mean, we know that she had the lack of oxygen at birth, and it was birth asphyxiation from the umbilical cord, and that led to what we are pretty sure is cerebral palsy, and also with, you know, cognitive and learning difficulties and that. But that really shows how long ago, how kind of in the dark we all were, and how in the dark maybe Ireland was at that time. It's funny because my memories are different. You know, obviously she wasn't in the same place when I was born, I think. I don't know what year she went to Beaufort, but I have, kind of mixed, I suppose, memories of Beaufort. The staff were always lovely. You know, everyone from the reception and all the people who worked there and everything. But I had the same kind of thing, I suppose, like walking through the corridors to where her room was always a bit, it used to scare me when I was very young. You didn't know what to expect. You know, there was this sort of uncertainty about it, I thought, as a child. But, the place was very bright and modern and everything like that. So it was quite different.
When I did the walk a few years ago, I purposely went through Foynes.
Oh yeah, of course.
Because I wanted to, because since being a kid, I just had this like idea of Foynes being this like evil place. I don't know what you could compare it to, Salem's Lot. And I purposely went past it because I kind of felt like, or through it, because I had this weird idea of it. I went to find the building, and the building is still there. But what I found out, it just kind of led me in this weird sort of tangent, but which I'm about to go on now for a moment. But it's cool, you know. It's like it was like something. It was what do you call a resolution for me? So there was a new home there. First of all, there was a new care home, which I went to the door of, and I put my hand on the door handle, and I then took my hand off the door handle, and I thought, I don't need to go here. You know, I don't need to go, and I have no reason to kind of revisit that in any way, but I was kind of pulled in that direction a little bit. Anyway, so I went to find, somebody told me, and I can't remember exactly who, but somebody told me that the building was still there, you know, who'd lived in the town for a while. So I went and checked it out. And like, weirdly, there it was, a kind of up the hill a little bit. And it did look like a weird kind of sort of prefab flat building with tall windows, and not as sinister as I imagined it would look. But what I found was that it had been built in the I think 20s or 1920s or 30s as a hotel for the first transatlantic flight passengers.
Oh, the seaplane,
yeah.
Wow.
Thing, what's no it called way. Again anyway that and then next to it was a sort of museum with one of these planes like sticking out of the front of it into the street almost. And I was just like, what's going on? It's like Disneyland here. This is supposed to be like some weird confirmation of my darkest childhood memories. And it's this kind of weird sort of wonderland of stuff. So I went to the museum, and they let me in for free because I told them what I was doing, and walked all around it and got to see the whole place. And I was kind of like sucked into the magic of it all, you know, of the kind of, wow, first transatlantic flights, this, and then the building being the hotel, you know. Wow. But the building also being like Aoife's hotel in some kind of weird way. And I had like, you know, what I would call a sort of breakthrough around my perception of the kind of grimness of the situation and the place. And I just, and it even though it was like a sort of, it was kind of intangible, really, because, you know, it was such a contrasting thing and such an unexpected thing. It just kind of blew my kind of all my preconceptions out of the water, but also gave me this kind of like idea that things are really not what you sometimes expect them to be. You know, this has just blown me away in a way that I have kind of, I don't know, sort of came to terms with it all in that moment or something, and felt like it was fine, things were fine again. And those memories, you know, and it made me think about when you're a kid, you create these really, you can create really powerful and lasting memories. Like, you know, what age would I have been? 3, 4, 5? I took on those as really negative memories, and it just stayed like that all my life. And you know, on that day, I kind of like sort of replaced those memories with something new, I guess, and a bit more grown up or whatever. So anyway, that's my
like an update.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Upgrade. But so yeah, so that was the building. It was built as a hotel. So there was something kind of like magical about that. Why the, you know, the purpose for that building was this like transatlantic flight thing, looking after Hollywood stars and all this kind of business.
Wow. And that is amazing. Wow, gosh.
And I think maybe just the other thing about going to visit IFA always was that there was never a feeling of any recognition. And I think that made on her part
from
of
her,
us.
I see. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, thinking now, Al, being in a car, you know, when you were going somewhere as a kid, it was usually to go somewhere kind of exciting. And actually it was, and I'm sure mom and dad tried to make it somehow exciting. Mm-hmm. And that was the picnic on the side of the road, yeah, or whatever. But, you know, you got somewhere to see your sister, and your sister didn't know who you were.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks for bringing that up.
A big one. Mm. Definitely. Sorry, Shun, did you?
No. I'm just you're right. It is a big one. It's very, I think it's something that might be really hard for people to understand, that, you know, that, you know, somebody who's there, who's your sister, your flesh and blood, doesn't give any sort of obvious reaction to hearing your voice or hearing other people's voices that she should recognize, or should, in, you know, inverted commas. And again, I grew up sort of with that already established, you know, that's who Aoife was and stuff. But I can remember every time, or I used to think that every time we sang her happy birthday, that she laughed and smiled. I don't know why I got that idea in my head. And I can remember when I was smaller, always singing it to her. And sometimes she'd smile and laugh and sometimes she wouldn't. But I was just like, yeah, I see, she does do it. You know, you just look for those kind of patterns. And it's so normal to look for you know, feedback from another person. That's what our brains want to do. They want to connect and stuff. And when you don't get that, you can kind of maybe make it up a bit yourself. I think that's what I used to do anyway.
Or think, what's the point? Which is what I think I did.
Okay.
What's the point in seeing her?
I see.
You know, because there's nothing coming, like you say, there's no feedback. Mm-hmm. But I think one of the interesting things I was thinking about this week is, you know, my Aoife was born on the 12th of November and my birthday is the 13th. And again, as a kid, your birthday is like the highlight of your year, pretty much, apart from, you know, Christmas and siblings' birthdays or whatever. Mm-hmm. So let's just say a week before my birthday, I'm getting excited about my birthday. And then the day before, possibly, or a couple of days before, depending on the day of the week, we had to go and see Aoife.
I see.
Or the day before my birthday, it was Aoife's birthday. And that must have been hard because, you know, there was no celebration possibly in our house for that in the same way there was for mine. Okay. So you kind of got this like excitement for your birthday. I know you can't see my kind of going up. And then there's a big kind of downer the day before.
I see.
Every year. And I still feel that. I still feel the day, you know, when it's Aoife's birthday, it's hard.
It must be.
And then you go. But then my birthday, I've always made a big deal out of celebrating it. And I think one of the reasons is because possibly mom and dad made a great effort too, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, to help me really celebrate that day. And my birthday is always a big deal for me.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting to think, you know, just that actually that week was full of emotions going up and down.
Yeah. I can imagine it now. And just hearing you saying it, of course, it makes total sense, you know, very a real emotional roller coaster before your birthday. And as a child, that must have been
weird.
Very strange. Yeah, very different to what your friends would have experienced and or anybody else you knew. Mm. What were you thinking, Al, with the sort of recognition or not getting sort of obvious feedback from Aoife?
Yeah, I guess I was just thinking about two things in relation to that. One was the sort of the going and there not necessarily being recognition. And then the other is going to visit. And the other is the place, isn't it? The place and the like other residents and the staff and everything. And there's, you know, at Fines anyway, it was particularly negative because of and, you know, this is not, it's impossible to blame anyone, but because of the staff and what they, the responsibilities they had, and also because of the other residents, it made it a really stressful situation for a child, for us as kids, I think. And you know, it's definitely enough to kind of give you a traumatic response or whatever. Mm. And then of course, not having that kind of coupled with Aoife being sort of unresponsive and all of that kind of did always make it a very uninviting prospect going to see her. And I mean, one thing I wanted to say about the unresponsive part as well was, you know, I wonder, and I'm not sure about this or anything, but I wonder if, you know, the carers, and this is where, you know, something that makes me feel sad sometimes when I think about it, is if, and I'm sure the carers, you know, knew her in a responsive way, mm-hmm. or knew her in a way that they could listen out for certain things she was communicating and how she was sort of talking to them or whatever. And, you know, in some ways I kind of feel sad that I didn't know her well enough to acknowledge those things. And it wasn't that I didn't try, or it's just that I didn't know to try, mm-hmm. or, you know, there was no kind of like, oh, when Aoife is hungry, she makes this sound, or when Aoife is upset, she sounds like this. I mean, you know, things like being upset, okay, maybe that's pretty obvious, but, you know, the more subtle things, there were no kind of pointers to those for us. And she may well have been communicating with us, but because of the subtle nature of it, we weren't tuned into it in a way. I wonder about, like, I can't say that for sure or whatever, but that's something I kind of think about sometimes.
No, absolutely, absolutely. And I do as well. And I feel that kind of, I feel that loss too, of not, you know, sort of, and maybe even sometimes in a weird way, like envy of the her carers who knew her sort of very, very well, better than I did. And I think that's definitely why I started working how I did, you know, going to Camp Hill and working and going from there, working with kids with special needs, because I just always sort of felt like I wanted to look after her, but it was too close to home. I just couldn't somehow, it was too painful, you know. But I've often wondered over the years as well, if, you know, certain sounds meant something and we just didn't learn her language. You know, we just weren't around her enough to learn her language. And she used to come home for weekends and that, you know, and we used to visit her and stuff, but that doesn't compare to being with somebody day after day, you know, which just wasn't possible in our situation.
Mm-hmm. But, there was that kind of element of it being a bit traumatic, I think, for us as well. And, you know, in that situation, you're not receptive, you know, when you're on survival mode, you could almost say, you know, when you're in that zone of feeling like you don't want to be there, mm-hmm. it doesn't feel like the right place to be, and all of that, you are kind of not listening out for subtle things from your sister, you know. And but as children, I'm not sure we were kind of aware of that at all, and the education around it wasn't there really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then the pattern repeated itself because every time it was the same. So it kind of becomes ingrained. And, you know, as humans, we need connection with someone. And I can't say I felt connection. And that's very hard when it's your sibling, your flesh and blood. And there was resentment and anger at having to go and see her when I was getting nothing back. And then that becomes the default mode.
Mm-hmm. So it became
became
something you just didn't, like over the years, you just didn't want to do, or you just felt less and less that you wanted to do it.
I don't think I ever felt I wanted to do it.
Sure.
That's the thing, you know, and it's not even that I felt it less and less. I think there's anger grew and resentment grew towards her. because of having to go and see her or have to have her home without dealing with the emotional side of it or the trauma side, as you said, Al, or understanding what was going on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, there weren't many people in our town where we grew up that had handicapped children or siblings or whatever. So you didn't really talk about it with anyone else that understood what was going on. And also, you didn't really talk about it. Mm-hmm. You know, feelings were not something that you talked about when we were growing up. And but there was an expectation there that you loved her or you wanted to spend time with her because she was your sister. So, and I think there was a mismatch then between what you were supposed to feel or should feel and how you felt. And I didn't really understand any of that, I think, until she died probably or close to, you know, later in life. But certainly the teenage years and under 10, I don't have any happy memories.
Mm-hmm. I probably second that. Agree. I probably agree with that as well. And like going to see her was always so hard and such a difficult thing to do. Even though, you know, often when I went, I get slight shiver just thinking about it now. You know, and I'm not ashamed to say it, but the situation, that was the situation we were in. And I guess, yeah, I think it was, I don't know what it was. Was it a traumatic response or whatever, or not getting something back for me? You know, it just felt like a real chore. You know, it just felt like a really difficult job that we had to do. Really difficult, and we weren't, you know, and there was nothing that could prepare you for it, sort of thing. You know, there was, and that's sad. That's really sad, but that's how it was. And and when it came to like school and, yeah, I mean, in general, the society we grew up in was very closed society emotionally and stuff. And I don't ever remember talking about Aoife at school or to friends or, you know, even within the family. And, you know, that just meant that I had my own personal reality when it came to Aoife. That wasn't a kind of shared Aoife culture. It was just, this is how I felt about it. And many of the feelings had been put there from when I was a little boy, frightened in going to Foynes. And they were probably the kind of guiding emotions for me, you know, in many ways. That sort of trauma reaction, just every time I thought about going to Steve, boom, that happened. So yeah, full on stuff.
Well, yeah, it is. It really is. It really is. And again, I'm reminded when I hear you guys talking like that, it was different for me. And I don't know if that's because when, you know, I suppose in primary school, I did always feel a bit sort of like, I did wonder if people felt sorry for me, you know, for having a sister, a disabled sister. But then when I went into secondary school, there were two other girls in my year who also had siblings with disabilities. So I think that really helped me. You know, I never felt like I was on my own. It was comforting, I guess, in a way. And I can remember in like fifth year, having a group of friends out, I think to celebrate Aoife's birthday. It might have been, I can't remember which birthday it was, but she was home and her friends came out and we had cake and stuff and I took photos and stuff. And that was, I think that was the only time that I kind of invited people in to Aoife's life and to our life with Aoife, you know, and it was a nice memory. It was a really nice memory. You know, I still have the photos in that.
I remember bringing, I remember going to the races one summer And I must have been about 14 or 15 because I was working in Graney's restaurant. And the gang that were working with me, we must have all been going to the races. And I brought them, Aoife was at home, and I brought them to see Aoife because I guess I had been talking about her or whatever. But, you know, it was really hard to bring people in as well, because I don't think you can prepare anyone.
I know. Yeah.
For how she was, because it's just so hard to imagine a human being that doesn't talk or acknowledge you or whatever, unless they're in a coma or something, you know?
Sure.
And yeah, and I can remember the girls that were there at the time just being quite shocked. And, you know, perhaps it left an impression on them as well, but it wasn't easy for people either,
yeah,
outside of the family.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah, it's hard for people to know what to say. It's like with death or with any difficult sort of life circumstance, you know, often people just don't know what to say. So, and you yourself know that, and you kind of have this feeling that you don't want to cause awkwardness for people as well, in a way, or sort of cause a difficult situation. So our tendency is to just avoid it, isn't it? I think it can be.
Protect them from it.
Protect them from it and protect us from that difficulty as well.
Yeah, and as well as that, I guess, you know, traditionally, you know, people with disabilities had been kind of hidden away a bit, mm-hmm, in Ireland. And it was changing when we were growing up, of course. But, you know, the mentality was still there, you know, to quite a degree, I think, especially in rural areas, I'd imagine. So I think that made it difficult to kind of not feel shame and not feel like you were perhaps putting other people in an awkward position if they were coming to visit, and basically easier to just kind of ignore it, push it away.
And I guess there was a kind of a religious undertone or overtone to it as well, with, you know, kind of, she was a gift, which really, that's not the language to use to a child to explain. I think, like, personally, I don't think that was the right way to try and explain a gift. And, you know, if she was smiling or whatever, kind of gesticulating, for want of a better, because, you know, that's kind of what she did. Mm-hmm. You know, she was talking to the angels, and, you know, she was special.
Oh, I never heard that.
And yeah, and, you know, and that was the older generation again. I mean, that would have been more, you know, grandma and that generation probably. But again, that just didn't sit well at the time. You know, it was very hard to reconcile that message, I think, for me, and especially the gift, because a gift is something you enjoy. And and that wasn't.
Yeah, I hear you, and I think like you said about the religious thing, probably has a lot to do with it. That the kind of the faith that there is a kind of higher power, in a sense, that's given her this position to. And yeah, and, you know, in so many ways, that's such a beautiful way to look at it. But we did kind of, maybe we grew up in a more rational household.
Cynical.
Rational.
No, but also questioning things.
Sure.
It's a different generation, and we tend to question stuff maybe a little bit more, or, I don't know, be a bit more dissenting in
for
our
sure.
opinions and views. And, you know, whatever people believe, that's what they believe, and that's okay. But perhaps it felt like that was what you were supposed to believe, or you should believe, and that wasn't okay.
Same.
That wasn't how you
same for me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, not at all. You know, I don't ever remember thinking that, you know, it just felt kind of heavy and dark. Yeah, not the opposite thing that maybe our grandma was feeling, whatever. Yeah.
You're being so open, and, you know, and really brave, and it's amazing.
So are you.
Thank you. I'm not really. I'm just sort of. I'm just realizing even more. You know. But I'm just realizing, you know, even more how different like everyone experiences life differently, that's a given, but you know, within a family, how different our experiences are. I mean, I know we do share many feelings about having Aoife as a sister, but I can just see, like, listening to you talking about it, it's such a different experience to mine, like, because I guess I didn't, you know, have Foynes, and because she was already there, like I said, when I was born. But I think the sort of maybe a familiar theme that we all have is the feeling of missing out on having a sister. I mean, we had a sister, but, you know, obviously it was so hard to connect to her, and it was very hard to have a relationship with her, you know, it was nobody's fault. It was just how it was. And I always, you know, I always wondered, and I still do, you know, who would she have been had she not had that, the umbilical wrapped around her neck at birth and been oxygen starved? Like, who would she have been? How would her personality have been? Would she have been, you know, had it like great sense of humor like us, been, you know, up for the crack? Would she have been really serious? Would we have teased her? You know, just like, and there's just like a lifetime that we've missed out on.
Well, she would have been herself. But, you know, it's a very, very, very strange feeling to mourn for something you never had, or to feel a sense of loss for something you never had. So the relationship that you had was not the one you'd like to have had. And you were mourned for the relationship you didn't have, almost, as opposed to the one you did have. And that's quite a hard thing to wrap your head around, or for me it is anyway. And, you know, I would have given anything to do, like if she was sitting here now, well, we wouldn't be having this conversation in the first place, but we'd be having a different one. And but then I also think perhaps if Aoife had been fine, you might not have been born soon. So that would be a travesty altogether. You know, so it's like life is life. And kind of, you know, from a philosophical standpoint, I don't know any different either. But it might take my own lifetime to not feel that sense of loss. Like part of me is missing.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's okay.
It is. It's hard. It's hard. But it is the way it is.
I kind of, it's a really interesting one, because I did used to spend a bit of time kind of fantasizing, is what I'd call it, I suppose, about what she may have been like. And partly because in some ways I wanted her to get better. I had a feeling that maybe, you know, one day Aoife would wake up and just go, "Hey world, here I am." You know, I did. Like, this is something I held on to as a child, and I think that was something to keep me afloat in some way. And that was just the most, that thought, that indulging that thought for me was really a beautiful thing, even though it was very fleeting. It was still a kind of, wow, imagine if all of that pain was taken away, I think is part of the thing. If all of my pain was taken away. And, you know, and that's the thing. It was, I think, again, through doing the walk, which I haven't really introduced so much, but I did this walk in 2016 where I walked from my house to my parents' house in memory of Aoife.
2 miles over the road.
It was 3 miles, actually. One of the things I sort of realized through doing that walk was, not like, one of the reasons I did the walk was that, because after Aoife died, I felt like, I'm skipping ahead here now. After she died, I felt like that life just went on as normal. I felt like a bit relieved, and I felt like life was going ahead as normal. And I thought, that's not normal, or at least there's something there must be something I need to resolve here. And at the time I didn't know, because I think I was pushing it, buried it, you know. But what I realized through doing the walk was that I lived in a state of grief all those years. And I lived in a state of grief for her and for who she maybe could have been, as if she wasn't who she was meant to be. And so I find and actually in some ways I took that on for myself too, that I wasn't who I was meant to be. But that's another story.
But you start your own podcast.
Yeah. Not who I was meant to be. I'm not sure it's got this amazing ring to it though. And that in itself is a really, yeah, that sense of grief and that sense of loss that I felt for Aoife and for me around Aoife, yeah, was definitely something really big, but also something I didn't want to go near. And I think, yeah, I just held on to those concepts even after she died. I think those concepts were just there, sort of floating around. She wasn't who she was meant to be. And then when I realized that the grief was always there, that's when I started to kind of open up my emotions to it in some way. I kind of realized, oh my God, there's like an overriding sadness within me in some way that affects everything I do. As a kid, I couldn't cope with it, with Aoife. So I pushed it away. I couldn't cope with it. And for whatever reason, that's what happened. And when you can't cope with something, you bury it or you go insane, whatever. And so it was buried. But bit by bit, since she died, and I couldn't cope with it within her lifetime. Mm-hmm. I think that is the truth of it for me. And so it was only after she died and that I could begin to understand my feelings around her life, which sounds so tragic in so many ways, but that was it. That's it, you know.
But I think it was, you know, I mean, I obviously don't want to speak for you, but for myself, it's more like you're afraid to say how you felt. You know, like to say that you felt anger or resentment towards Aoife, who had never done anything in her life to you. That just sounded like monster type behavior. And, you know, I suppose there was guilt associated with that and shame again or whatever. And so it was easier just not to think about it. But like you say, if you suppress or repress something, I mean, it's going to come out eventually. And I suppose there was relief in a way when Aoife died, because it allowed me to open up. And I can remember having a conversation with a conversation about how I felt resentment towards Aoife with Uncle Jim. And he was absolutely fantastic, actually. And it was a big thing for me to say that out loud, that, you know, that this is what I felt towards her. And he said, I think, you know, his kind of what he said to me was, you know, being able to say it is the start of the process for you to feel it and to get through it.
Shame needs secrecy. And when it doesn't have secrecy, then it loses its power, doesn't it? So it's really great that you were able to trust somebody and talk like that so openly, and a family member especially.
I suppose he's a priest as well, so he was used to listening to people talking about all sorts of things, maybe. I don't know. But, you know, he's I like talking to Jim, and he made it easy for me to say stuff like that. And I think once I opened that part of me, then, yeah, I suppose some sort of healing began, or, you know, yeah, the world went on, even though that's how I felt. And I can take a deep breath and I can keep going. And I'm not a monster.
No, you're
Well, Alan might think I am, but I'm not.
I haven't thought that for like at least a couple of weeks.
I was going, I thought you were going to say a couple of minutes, but yeah. But is it any wonder I was a monster with you, Alan? Because we just didn't know how to cope. So I took a lot of it out on you.
Well, yeah, and you know, we were our own. It just happened as well that we are who we are. You know, I'm kind of, we're just different. We have very different characters, and we just rubbed each other up the wrong way all the time.
But we also had hurt and pain and whatever going on, and that was probably a bit of fuel to the fire.
It definitely must have been. I think it prevented us from having a sort of a meaningful relationship as kids. Definitely. Yeah. It was tense.
But look at us now, huh?
I know.
It's funny, you know, Alan, you saying that, like, having a sort of fantasy that Aoife would wake up one day and be healthy. I can remember when she came home for weekends and we used to share a room. And I used to imagine at night that she would get up, that she had some kind of secret zip, that she'd open her outer kind of body or what we could see and crawl out of it. And she was actually a really fully able human, and she'd walk around and just do totally normal things. Like at night, she'd sneak out of the bedroom, I'd imagine, and go into the kitchen and like eat an apple. And like, how amazing would that be if she could do something as simple as that? And it's just like, when I think of it now as an adult, it's the simplicity of those tasks I imagine her doing makes me realize how disabled she was and how precious our, you know, our movement is and our ability is. And it's it's a lovely memory. It makes me sad to think about it too, but it makes me happy as well. Like imagining her going in and sneakily turning on the telly and watching cartoons at 2 a.m. or something. And then seeing that it's getting bright, so she sneaks back into the bedroom and puts on her suit again and pretends to be asleep.
I love it. I love the idea of the suit. Especially if you like, imagine if you'd found the suit when she wasn't in it. What would your reaction have been?
But, well, mine would have been pretty cool because I knew about it. So.
Oh yeah, totally. That's so cool though. And maybe
I don't think I ever had those kind of.
No.
No, I don't. I don't think so. Interesting.
It is interesting.
Yeah.
You were going to say something there, Al.
No. I don't know. I don't know. I like the suit thing, even though they were quite weird memories, those ones of her waking up and being like, "Hey," it was kind of, there was something fun about it as well. Definitely, you know, I think probably in a similar way to the suit thing you're talking about.
Yeah,
there's a similar. Yeah, there was something kind of fun about that as well. So because I don't want to kind of like go, the pain I was in, and if only it was like this and blah blah,
I suppose it does teach you in a way not to take things for granted, and even though I often have to remind myself of that, I think it's a great way of reminding yourself of that. And you know, I think we all, you know, not to be able to, never having taken a single step or uttered a single word, that actually it's kind of on us to use our voices. Mm-hmm. Because we can, because we have one, and it's on us to move around the world and do stuff because we can. Mm-hmm. And they're gifts that we can't take for granted. Now, there is your gift.
No, that's amazing. Yeah. And I don't think I've, yeah. I don't think I really thought about it like that. And I loved that.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Thank you.
I remember when I did the Camino, it was a different walk, but, you know, walking on the Camino, and I had one day and it was the worst bloody day ever. My feet were just like in absolute tatters with blisters, and it was 35 degrees and I'd gotten lost in the morning and it was just awful. And I was trying to convince myself not to be such a miserable like a cranky walker. And then actually I was able to walk. And that was the only thing probably that kept me going that day, was that Aoife couldn't do this, but I could. And I just had to keep going to get to the next place. And that was really, that was one of the big drivers for me, was because I really just wanted to lie down on the ground and hope somebody found me. It's just bloody miserable. And, you know, come on, like, for God's sake.
No, I know the feeling.
Not blister.
Good.
That's beautiful.
Good perspective. And I guess, you know, I did have the same thoughts myself when I was doing my walk. But I really like the idea of bringing that concept of into everything I do, you know, that concept of here's what maybe Aoife couldn't do, or into more stuff in my life, you know, because I definitely used it within the walk, but to have it as a kind of, yeah, as an affirmation or a mantra, I quite like that idea.
At this point, the conversation sort of came to a natural end, so we decided to leave it there. Thank you for listening to that, and I hope you could take something away from today's episode. Perhaps you could strongly relate to it in your own life experience. Maybe it's something completely new and perhaps a sort of point of view that you hadn't thought about before. But whatever you take away, thank you for listening, and take care. See you next time.